Well, hey there, it's a Tuesday night. Welcome to the Mead House, and we've got a packed up, ramped up show for you here tonight. We do have a special guest. We'll be joining him here in just a little bit, but hey, welcome to the house. Ryan is off tonight, guys, so it's just Aaron, Mississippi, and Jeff and I, J.D. Webb, here with you tonight. So let's... I'm going to forego what's that thing called that I do all the time? Facebook. That's right. See where my mind's at tonight. Jeez. I didn't get a chance to get out to the Facebook, and actually, that's not true either. I purposely didn't go after the Facebook because I know we had a packed up show tonight. So I want to get the prelims out of the way. Again, welcome to the Mead House. We live at themeadhouse.com. Pretty simple. You can call the show anytime. We are live, 818-921-4680. If you're listening live from themeadhouse.com, the phone number's right there on the player. You'll see it. And again, Aaron Martin, Mississippi Chris Spencer, Jeff Schauss in the house. My name is J.D. Webb. Let's go right into what we all are drinking here. And I think it was Aaron. We were just in pre-show, and I heard, man, I heard the top pop, or whatever you want to call it, and I heard it being poured into a glass. Man, that sounded good. What do you got?
What it tastes every bit as good as it sounds. Actually, in honor of our special guest tonight, I'm opening up a bottle here of a Fox Hill Meadery Mead. This is a meadery located in Asheville, North Carolina. And, earlier, I guess it was this summer, went to visit this meadery. They do complimentary tours and tastings. Went there with my sister and my wife and had a tasting of the different meads. And one of my favorites that we sampled, it's actually one of his special reserve meads. It's a pretty hefty mead coming in at 16% alcohol by volume, and it's an off-dry mead. Very, very big, robust flavors going on here. Looking at his recipe, a significant percentage of this mead comes from buckwheat honey, and it's also aged for quite a while on oak as well. So definitely a nice sipping mead as the temperatures are getting a little more cool outside. This one will definitely warm you up.
Wow, sounds good. Jeff Schauss, in the house. So what's in your cup tonight, bud?
Well, I'm having a glass of my Saison Bragging with a little side of Crow here because, everything about this recipe came out great except the carbonation.
Wow.
I opened this bottle and it was completely flat. I've had some that were a little bit carbonated, but not very much. So, yeah, I'm a little bit bummed, but that just means it's one more thing to figure out for a future batch.
Yeah. How did you carbonate it? With priming sugar? Or?
Well, kind of. This was made with the blend of basswood and clover honey that I got. So I used about 7.2 ounces, if I remember right, of that as a priming sugar. And it may just be that the yeast was kind of tired, worn out, and just wasn't really willing to truck it. I did accidentally overshoot the alcohol content of this from 10 to closer to 11.5. So that may have something to do with it, too.
Any chance of you've got it all bottled up? Can you pop the tops and put them all back in a container and try to recarbonate, or is it pretty much a done deal?
You know, I could try it, but I'm at this point. I'd be willing to. I'd be worried about oxidation ruining it. I'm trying to transfer it out of bottles into a carboy or a keg or something. So.
Yeah,
I think this batch is just going to be a flat bracket, and future batches, you know, I've got a keg coming to me this Christmas, so we'll try it that way next time.
Hell, long as it tastes good, right?
Exactly, yeah. No, just because it's flat doesn't mean it isn't tasty. It's pretty tasty.
And at 11%, after three or four of them, it won't matter anyway, right?
After two, I think I'd my taste estimation would be high.
Mississippi, joining us from somewhere in Mississippi. Chris, what's in your glass tonight?
I got a little Magner's Hard Apple Cider.
Oh, dude, and I looked.
Yeah, English cider. It's actually an Irish cider, and it's the best I've found stateside, so I'm sticking with it and until mine gets finished, and then I won't have to buy any more cider.
There you go. And, man, I've been looking. I got one more place that I haven't looked yet, and that's a little liquor store down here on the corner by me. To find all kinds of different kinds of mead and stuff that you don't find even at the BevMo and at the Total Wine. So I'll have to get down there and see if I can't find that Magner's. The old man, he's drinking Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Ale again. I love this stuff. And I'm hoping that my Braggot will come out something like this. I got a taste of it when it came out of the fermenter and got racked, and after I had put the bourbon in it, and man, it tastes good. Ooh, it tastes good. I can't wait to get that thing into a keg and get it carved up. And I did start a second one. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But, hey, we've got some business to attend to here. I'm going to give our guest a call here and get him on the line. In the meantime, hey, if you're joining us tonight, you can check out the house we live in, themeadhouse.com. It's real simple. We do have a Facebook deal. That's just simply The Mead House if you go to the Facebook. And we seem to be picking up quite a bit of traffic on the Facebook.
Hello, Fox Hill Meadery.
Pretty cool, too.
Hello?
Yes, sir. This is The Mead House. This is J.D. Webb. Aaron Martin, Mississippi, Chris Spencer, and Jeff Schaus. And Aaron, I'm just going to turn it over to you and let you do the introductions.
Sounds good. Well, without further ado, I would like to introduce Jason.
Lost him.
Oh, did we lose him?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why. Let's try him again. I heard him say hello a couple times.
Same here. Sounds like we had him.
Yeah, we'll have to try. It may be that I wonder if that's a cell phone or a landline. Do you know for sure?
Hello.
Hello there. Can you hear us?
Hey. Yes, I can hear you now.
There you go. This is the Mead House radio show. So, Aaron, go ahead. Take it away, my friend.
Sounds good. Well, like to welcome Jason Russ to the program tonight. Jason is the owner of Fox Hill Meadery, located in Asheville, North Carolina. A few months ago, over the summer, I was down there on a vacation and stopped into his meadery with my wife and with my sister for a tour and a complimentary tasting. Came away just really enjoying the different meads that we tried there. He has some really phenomenal ones. I think on one of the previous shows, I was drinking one of his ginger apricot meads. He's got a really fantastic blackberry, a peach. And as I described earlier, in honor of Jason, I'm drinking his special reserve, which is an oaked buckwheat honey mead. And it's just out of this world. So welcome to Jason. We're excited to have you on the program. I think tonight we wanted to bring you on and just talk about mead making and your mead making philosophy, maybe ask some questions. And that's really what this show is all about. It's just a couple of guys sitting around the table talking about mead. So welcome to the program, Jason.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. And good choice on your choice of drink tonight.
Absolutely. Yeah, up here in Wisconsin, it's starting to cool off a little bit, down in the 40s. So now that it's cooling off, this is definitely a winter warmer.
Yeah, that's our biggest one, and definitely a sitting by the fire type of sipping mead.
I'm gonna beat Aaron to the punch here. That's the oaked one, right? Right, Aaron?
It is, yes.
How much oak? Well, of course, I'm sure this is a pretty large batch, but what kind of oak, and how long do you let it sit on oak?
Yeah, we actually use oak on all of our meads, but most of them we put such a small amount in that you really wouldn't notice it very much. It's just kind of there as a balancing flavor. Now, that particular one, the Special Reserve, I use two different types of oak, and a French dark, and usually an American or a Hungarian medium toast. And it sits on there for 2 to 3 years for the Special Reserve.
Oh, wow. Now, do you put them both in at the same time, or you use one oak and then the other oak, or it all goes in at the same time?
It all goes in the same time, yeah. We use stainless steel fermenters, but we put in oak cubes, and that way we can put in as little or as much as we like, and we can blend the oak. We can do whatever we want with it. And, in that case, it all goes in at the same time right from the start and just sits there for quite a while.
Interesting. Imagine how good it would be if he fermented in plastic buckets.
Yeah, that's kind of an inside thing here on this show. There's a couple of us that use stainless steel fermenters. And then old Chris, I just can't pry him away from those plastic buckets of his. So.
Well, whatever works for you. I know there's some pros that use plastic as well, and I don't know if it makes a difference. I've never tried it personally, but I always feel good with the stainless steel.
Yeah,
so does JD. I was saying that they're always kidding me about using my plastic buckets, and I pick at them for using stainless steel. I said, if they ever make a stainless steel female doll, JD will be divorced.
How much mead do you make at a time, Jason?
We do 150-gallon batches at a time.
I just don't have room for that big of a fermenter. one other question I had, while we're on the subject of peach mead, that's one that I'm kind of stuck on. The one I'm doing now, let me ask you, when it comes to doing peaches, how do you make your peach mead? Are you using the raw peach, or are you using some kind of a peach puree, or how does that work? What do you find that works best?
Yeah, we start off with a peach puree, and with all of our meads that we add fruit to, we put the fruit in right from the start, and so it's fully fermented fruit. We don't ever add juice or extract or anything at the end. My personal feeling is that kind of tastes like, it tastes like you've added juice to a mead at the end there. So I like to ferment the fruit right away, right off the bat, and fully ferment it. And for the peach, it actually gives it, just like grape wine. Grape wine doesn't taste like grape juice, right? It tastes different. So our peach mead, it has an interesting fruit flavor that you might not recognize it as peach right away. Unless someone told you it was peach. It's fairly dry, and the peach actually lends a little bit of a kind of a sour note to it almost that complements the sweetness of the honey really nicely. It's one of my favorites. It's a really nice mead.
So I'm not that far off then, Chris.
No. Jason, this is Chris. JD's got a peach going from a recipe that I gave him that I've done quite a few times, and I told him up front, I said, I warned him that peaches have this weird acidity to them that's kind of hard to describe. Do you find that also?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's almost the sourness. It almost tastes like a sour beer in some ways.
Mm-hmm. But in some ways, it's almost like putting your tongue to a battery. Not that intense, but it's that same kind of, it's like almost carbonated without any carbonation, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, I kind of know what you mean. Yeah, yeah, there's a sharpness to it. There's something that kind of lively on your tongue. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I would describe it as a battery, though. It's probably not the way I would describe it in an advertisement.
The point is, for us homebrewers who want to work with them, I think you need to be aware that peaches do have this strange acidity that can kind of come across different than anything else. Deal with it.
The strange thing about this peach that I got going now is it's a small batch, 3 gallon batch, and I used 25 pounds of peaches, and all mashed up. They sat on some enzyme, some pectic enzyme for a couple of days, and I wanted it. I started out at thinking it was 11:20. I wanted it somewhat dry, or at least I didn't want a sweet mead. In other words, I wanted something close to a Chardonnay, but with a peach flavor. And that's what I'm getting now. But it took 25 pounds of peaches to get what I think is a very mild peach flavor. It's a very mild. And I think had I used anything less than that, I probably wouldn't. It might have smelled like peaches, but it certainly wouldn't have tasted like peach.
Well, that's a lot. That's a lot of peaches. You basically made peach wine.
Pretty much. I love the taste. It lacks in mouthfeel. I added some FT Blanc tannin to it today, which is typical for using in white wines. Hopefully it'll give it a little bit of mouthfeel, because it's awfully watery right now, and real thin. I'm hoping here in a couple of months after that tannin settles in, that I'm able to get a nice mouthfeel out of it. Like I said, it tastes good. It's got that tartness to it, but it's calming down quite a bit now, Chris, than it was, when we first talked about it.
I think a little time when some of your honey flavor really starts to come back strong, I think it's going to even out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing from Jason and the perspective that he adds the fruit right up front. It seems like the more and more I learn about Melomels and the more opinions I get on it, it seems like that seems to be the prevailing preferred method is to add it up front. JD, we're talking about yours kind of mellowing out and evening out over time. And I'm thinking of the peach that I put together, similar to Jason. I used a peach puree and noticed that, initially I didn't even notice any peach at all, which was interesting because I added it in secondary. So you might think you'd get more of that kind of like peach juice type flavor. And over time, that started to come back to it, but it's interesting how in that case the peach flavor returned over time.
Is that a process that you developed before turning professional, Jason, using purees, or had you worked with whole fruits before and just came to the conclusion that that wasn't an option?
Yeah, when I was experimenting as an amateur, I tried it both ways, and naturally when you ramp things up and you're doing a 150-gallon batch, it's a lot easier to get, 150 pounds of puree than to mash up whole fruit at that stage. And even at the small scale, I like the results of the puree. You get a lot out of it, pound for pound. You're getting a lot out of the puree, of course. And, the flavor I always thought was great. Never had a problem with it. So consistency is there. everything you needed really was there. And I'll say this about Melomels in general also, that I found that they are, it's very interesting to experiment with different yeasts with Melomels. You know, some yeasts respond to the fruit differently than other yeasts. And some yeasts will put out more estery, fruity flavors and aromas than others. So if you're making a Melomel, particularly, you know, something like a peach that's not really, you know, all that noticeable as peach unless you use a ton of it, like you said, you might want to try a different yeast, try a couple different yeasts and see what you think.
Yeah. Is you, well, let me ask you, what kind of yeast did you use in your peach?
Well, I use one that actually you cannot get at in small quantities. You know, you go to the homebrew shop, they've got about maybe 5 or 10 different ones in 5 gram packets or something. The one I use for my Melomels does not come like that. I get them in much larger quantities. And although I'm pretty open about most of my ingredients, that's a bit of a secret actually with me.
Okay.
Fair enough.
All I can say is experiment. Yeah.
I'm the same way with my flat buckets. People wonder why my meat is so good. I don't tell them it was in a plastic bucket.
Well, that's you know, none of us here on the show are, you know, what I would call professional mead makers at all. We're the home hobbyist, home brewer, you know, that we enjoy, you know, making, coming up with our own concoctions, and we've done plenty of experimenting. I think the last big one we did was the coffee thing that, you know, guys, I don't know if I don't think I'd call it a bust. I you know, we may not have explored it, you know, all the way. And I know Chris had mentioned that he was still playing around with a coffee experiment too. But I mean, that's the
I told you what came out good with mine. When I did everything that everyone said not to do, I came out with what I was looking for in the first place.
Yeah.
So basically, everyone was saying don't dare steep your coffee hot. You know, it's got to be cold brewed. And
yeah.
So basically, I took everything that people said not to do and ended up making a good coffee mead. So yeah. I don't know.
What's some good advice to give home mead makers, Jason? Now that you've been through all of this,
it just sort of some general advice to make a better mead.
Yeah.
Well, the biggest thing is to keep your yeast happy. You want to use the right nutrients. You want it to be at the right temperature. And like I said before, you want to experiment with different yeasts because some yeast will work better maybe for Melomel. Another one might work better for a Methaglen. So play around with the yeast. A lot of mead makers I know, a lot of home brewers, they just use champagne yeast, or they find maybe one yeast that they think is good and they just use it all the time. So mess around with that. You know, yeast is the one doing all that work for you. And there's hundreds of them out there, and definitely try as many as you can, because they're all different, and they all make a different mead.
How long have you been making mead?
Well, I started, I was brewing beer 20 years ago. I got introduced to mead maybe 15 years ago. Did about 5 or 6 years of pretty solid experimentation. I did a couple hundred batches before going pro. So, yeah, I started making mead somewhere around 2001, 2002.
So the beer brewing thing, that seems to ring a bell around this place, doesn't it, guys?
Oh, yeah.
I've got a question for you, Jason. We had Michael Fairbrother on a couple of weeks ago, and we started talking about how long from pitching the yeast to actually having a drinkable mead. And so I was just wondering, what's your typical time now? Not, this is not counting, you know, something you age for 2 or 3 years, but just your normal line of meads. What kind of time frame are you looking at?
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, again, this comes down to keeping that yeast happy. If you use the right nutrients, you know, and the right temperature and all that stuff that I was talking about, there's no reason why you can't have a good mead after just a couple of months. Now, normally I age mine about 5 or 6 months, but it's really more than they need a lot of times. I'll taste them at, you know, a few weeks. I'll taste them in a few months, et cetera. And most of them are ready very quick because if you get a good fermentation and you're using the right yeast and everything, there's just no need for how should I put it? You know, there's this thing out there on the internet, you know, that people say, oh, well, you got to age mead, you got to age it. It's only good after a couple of years. Or if you screw it up, just wait a few years and it'll get better. Well, that's not necessarily true either. You know, if you do it right, there's no need for it to be all that low. For your typical mead, you know, 11, 12, 13% mead, nothing too strong, nothing too crazy or oaky or anything. Your basic mead, couple months.
That's, you know, you mentioned the internet, and I'm, you know, I go back to when I first started in this whole thing and all the reading and everything that I was doing and talking to different people. And my God, the information out there just runs the gamut. And, you know, it's funny you should say that, because, you know, I mean, there's some folks out there that, you know, well, we got one sitting at the table here, I know, but, you know, to be able to produce a mead in 3 weeks and put it in a glass and drink it is one thing. But then, you know, us older folks like me, I tend to think that, you know, something like this needs time to develop. And I think best character comes with age. Of course, that's what my wife tells me. So, I mean, is that a philosophy that you agree with, or because I know some meaderies, you know, you can't afford to let mead sit on the shelf, and I get that. But then on the other hand, is time an advantage to making good mead at home?
Well, like I said, with kind of a, you know, a basic mead, if you look at our lineup, we've got four or five that are pretty basic meads. They're not terribly strong, not terribly oaky. And like I said, I age those 5 or 6 months, and that is really more than they need. There's really no difference between 3 months and, say, a year or two with those meads. No difference as far as making the quality better. Of course, the mead changes. You know, it does oxidize over that time, and it's going to age, and it's going to change. But most of our meads, I would say, are at their peak between just a few months and maybe 9 or 10 months. And we typically bottle them after 5, 6, 7 months in the fermenter. I taste every single one many times before I bottle them. The more the better, right? Yeah. And we only bottle them when I feel that they're ready. But they really never need any sort of, you know, super aging. The only exceptions to those are the special reserve in the apple, which we age, you know, for at least a year and a half to 2 years, because these are 15-16% meads with lots of oak on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jason, I was wanting to ask you a question. One of the meads that you released that I think is just really fascinating is the ginger apricot mead. Two flavors that really work quite harmoniously together. You know, definitely a real nice strong ginger flavor with a, at least for my perception, a little more subtle apricot flavor in kind of in the background there. And I'm curious, going back to your days of experimentation, Is there any like approach that you had when you were creating a new recipe? Did you kind of have the end product in mind in terms of what you were looking for? Or were you more focused on like the inputs and the ingredients you were putting into it and then just kind of having a surprise on the back end of what it turned out to be? Was there any approach that you would typically take there with your experiments?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially with that particular mead, because the very first mead I ever made was ginger mead. I just thought that the sharpness of the ginger would go perfectly with the sweetness of honey. So ginger was actually the first mead I made. I made several ginger meads before throwing in a little bit of apricot in there to kind of round it out. So my philosophy with mead making has a lot to do with the balance of the end product. And that comes, I think, from brewing beer before I brewed mead. You know, you always have this, with beer, balance is really important. So you always have that in your head. So I always had in my head with the mead too. And so you'll see with our meads, you know, I've got the ginger, I've got the blackberry, I've got the peach. Everything I add to the mead is always something that will balance out the sweetness of the honey. I don't have like a vanilla mead because it's sweet plus sweet. You know, it doesn't really balance the honey. So when I go into a new recipe, that's always what I'm thinking is balance. And I don't want it to be out of whack. And so the ginger is just a perfect example of that. I just thought, you know, like I said, ginger and honey go well together. It was kind of one dimensional. So I was thinking of some fruits and other spices to add, and the apricot came to mind. And you know, I just think it comes out a very drinkable, balanced mead in the end.
So did you have, this is Jeff, sorry. Did you have other contenders besides apricot that were tasty that you tried out, or was it pretty much you tried the apricot and went, oh, this is really good. This is the winner here.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had other contenders in my head, and I never actually went through and made them because I was drinking a Magic Hat number 9 beer, which, as you guys probably know, is kind of famous for its apricot-like flavor. And it just kind of came to me. I said, this is what my ginger mead needs. It needs some apricot in there. So that's what I did. And very first batch I did, it was just great. And so it was ginger apricot ever since.
All right.
Sounds good. Have you ever gotten into doing any braggots at all?
Yep, tried a few braggots. Never could make a good one. It's actually a little bit of a disappointment for me because I've tried other people's braggots and enjoyed them, and I never could make a good one myself, even though I was a beer brewer before a meat brewer.
Well, what was the you know, this has been our latest experiment, and what we do on the show here is we gather up an idea, and then we go into it for a couple of weeks, and then throw a recipe together. The latest one here at the Meat House, we've all been working on are braggots. And I don't know that I like the traditional style of meads, like the melon. I really haven't had anything that really turns me on, except one bottle of a braggot that Aaron had sent me. And I thought, man, that's the one. That's what I need to be making here at home. So what was your difficulty, if you don't mind talking about it, that you had with making braggots?
Yeah, I just could never get, again, with me, it always comes back to the balance. And, you know, I want something to be drinkable, balanced, you know, complex. And every time I made a braggot, it just tasted like, maybe it tastes like a beer that I threw some honey in. Maybe it tasted like a mead that I threw some grain in. You know, it just never really tasted like a well-rounded, you know, finished, polished drink. And could never make a good one. I can't say I tried a zillion of them, but I did maybe four or five. I did maybe some porters, some stouts. Then I tried maybe a hoppier variety, thinking that might do it, and just wasn't my thing. Maybe it came back to that yeast that I'm always harping on. Maybe I wasn't using the right one.
Yeah.
Jason, I've got a question and then a suggestion. First of all, what is your favorite kind of beer? What's your favorite style?
My favorite kind of beer? Well, I'm a big fan of big Belgian beers, so doubles and triples.
Okay. So let's make a suggestion. I'll just throw this out there. Since all of us are working on different ones, and we're all doing something pretty drastically different from each other, we will send you a sample when we get them finished and they're ready. And if you like one of them enough, you can start making it and call it the Meat House Edition.
There you go.
Sounds good. Send me all the samples you want. I'm always willing to try things.
Yeah.
You get to add a braggot to your lineup, and we get publicity.
Publicity.
So, yeah. So yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Send those samples along, and I'll let you know what I think. If you can make a good one, we'll talk.
And if you don't want to take it, at least we can get your feedback on what you think, what we should change or what you like and didn't like.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to touch it for you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Love the synergy.
Well, I mean, this is what it's all about. I mean, Jason, we started this show, and I think we're on, I think this is number 29. And the four of us, I knew Chris. I used to produce a show over at Got Mead, and that's where I knew Chris from. And when I left that show, Chris and I stayed in touch, and he says, "Hey, what about doing another show?" So okay, fine. So then I ran into I don't know if I found Jeff or Aaron first. I don't remember, guys. You got to help me out. But
you did find Aaron first because I was actually your first guest.
I found Aaron. I found Aaron. I think it was on a Facebook page or something. And yep. you were doing something, but it was really intriguing, and it really piqued my interest. So I contacted him and said, "Hey, how about doing a show with me and another guy?" And sure. And then Jeff was a guest on our show. He was doing an experiment with yeast, or no, you were doing an experiment with nutrients. And I mean, Jeff is like a mead head, okay? I mean, he is into this mead stuff. So I thought, you know what, we need him on the show, and so that's how Jeff came about. So, but we're just, like I said, we're just home brewers, just sitting around a table yakking about mead. We come up with some harebrained ideas, and we'll throw them in a fermenter and. See what happens. And I think that's the exciting part about doing this mead and even making beer, which some of us have gotten into. I just think that's the whole, that's the whole thing for me, is just being able to put things in a fermenter and just, see what it comes out to.
Into the brewing beer too, because mostly because of this braggot experiment, because I believe you can't make a good braggot unless you can make a good beer. The same way you can't make a good sizer unless you can make a good cider. So, I think if I'm going to make a good braggot, I've got to learn to do a lot better beer than what I do.
Were there talk about the early days? So you're making mead at home. Talk about some of the mistakes that you came across. Doing all these experiments. Is there anything that sticks out in your mind at all?
Sure. you're bringing up some bad memories here. Well, I did about 200 test batches before starting Fox Hill, and I never had a shortage of guinea pigs because I knew lots of brewers and people like that who were into it. And, you know, you throw everything in there, like you said. You're throwing stuff into a fermenter and see what comes out. Well, I remember one time going to meet some friends of mine, and I brought probably five or six of my latest meads. One of them, a guy said it tasted like toothpaste, and that was blueberry and something else in it, I can't remember. Another one, a guy said he called it sneaker mead. It was not his favorite. So, you know, you learn some harsh lessons along the way, but without those people giving you honest feedback, you know, I never would have got where I am. So I only had to throw out one mead. There was only one. It was cardamom, which was terrible.
Really?
You know, with spices, as I'm sure you guys and your listeners know, with spices, if you overdo it, you're screwed. You know, you ruin the batch. With fruit, you can overdo it, and that's okay. It just gets more fruity. But spices, especially something like cardamom, I mean, she's... That was bad.
Yeah, I tried with that Thai curry mead, and it was, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just laughing at the sneaker mead and toothpaste, thinking of the Robitussin mead that I made.
I made a cherry mead one time that was kind of like Robitussin. You know, it actually tasted pretty good. The only problem is people have that association in their heads with cherry, and it's so hard to get rid of that.
Isn't it? You know, I mean, I think that develops when you're a kid, because that seems to be the I don't know if it's the only flavor that these pharmaceuticals have in their pantry to throw in as cough syrup. But I mean, why does it always have to be cherry? You know?
Yeah. Well, especially 30 years ago, right, when we were kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Jason, though, you were talking about getting other people to taste and see what they think. One lesson I learned is if you're going to have people taste your mead, you need to have people who enjoy mead and who know what mead is, because there's a lot of people out there who do not like mead, unfortunately. So you can't hand a wine drinker mead. And, you know, especially a melomel, if it's a blackberry or something, they have these preconceived notions. And so you've got to find people who actually like mead to get a good, honest opinion.
Yeah, no doubt. Or educate some friends, you know. Because, preconceived notions are hard to get over, and it takes people a lot of time, sure.
Do you still brew beer?
Oh, I haven't brewed a batch of beer in about 3 or 4 years.
Oh, so you've pretty much committed yourself to nothing but mead then.
Yeah, I've been doing some cider. Got some friends here who wanted some help making hard cider, so I've done that the last couple of years with some local apple pressing. Well, that was fun. But for the most part, yeah, I'm just doing the professional brewing at this point. Not a whole lot of home brewing going on.
Well, cider, we've been talking about cider here recently, too. And we've actually got a recipe that Chris has been talking about here that he picked up. Well, actually, he thought he was coming up with a pretty fantastic sounding recipe. Come to find out, the same basic recipe has been listed over on Homebrew Talk. And so,
yeah, for like 7 years.
But it's made with what is it, Chris? It's made with grains and extract, malt extracts, and hops,
yeah,
and that kind of thing.
A little bit of malt extract and a little bit of caramel, 120L, and just a very small amount of hops. And like I said, when I started thinking about it, I started thinking about all the shortcomings that most of the apple juice that I get has, which is you know, to make a good cider, traditionally you would have had cider apples, you would have had bitters and, you know, bitter sharps. And so I started thinking, you know, and it has a lack of body too, to some extent. So I was trying to find a solution for this. And because of the Braggot experiment and my exposure to beer brewing, I'm thinking, well, let's see, we got malt, which adds some body and some mouthfeel. We got hops that can stand in for some bitterness. And suddenly I thought I had come up with the one recipe that was going to get me in the Home Brewers Hall of Fame. And, you know, I thought I was genius. And then I get on the internet and somebody who's been doing it for like 7 years and it's been done by thousands of people already. Almost the exact same thing I came up with. It was one of those gong moments, you know, where you see it and you go, gong, you know, it's like, dang.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. You put all that work into it and it was already done. Yeah. A good friend of mine, when I first made cider, maybe 16, 17 years ago, said, put a little malt extract in it. And yeah, I had that tip back then as well.
Yeah.
Is that, are you still doing that to your ciders?
Sometimes. Yeah. Not always, but, sometimes. Yeah. It does definitely add a little body, little complexity, nice flavor to it. Yeah.
Now, are your ciders sweet ciders? How would you describe your cider? No.
I like them pretty dry. Yeah. Maybe not quite bone dry, but not far off of there. Yeah.
How are you achieving that then? How do you get to that balance?
Well, it's pretty easy to dry out a cider, you know, because it's only a 5-7% drink, right? So, pretty much any yeast will dry it out near bone dry. And if it takes it too dry, what I like to do is I'll keg it and then throw in a little lactose, which is kind of cheating. It was kind of cheating, but it works. So it's almost like, you know, you would put that, I don't know if you guys have ever made a milk stout before, but you would add lactose to a milk stout because it's unfermentable milk sugar. So if you got cider in a keg, you can just add a little lactose to it and it adds a little sweetness without ever fermenting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, knowing that there aren't any cider apples to be had here in the United States, you know, I'm always looking for a nice English type cider. I like them on a drier side. I don't particularly care for the Martinelli sweet type apple ciders. And I'm just curious as how you reach that balance with the with the tartness level and the apple flavor, you know.
Yeah. Well, of course, it all depends where you are and what sort of apples you can get. I like Granny Smith apples. So, in fact, in our apple mead, about half of the pressed apple juice is Granny Smith. Gives a nice acidity, tartness, you know, tannins to the mead. And that works great for a straight cider as well.
Okay.
Now, Jason, I'm recalling that apple mead. I actually have a couple of bottles of that yet here, maybe opening one up next week for Thanksgiving. Refresh my memory. What other adjuncts do you add to that? Any spices, anything like that as well?
Nope. No spices. No.
No spices.
It's all just pressed apples. And honey. There's not even any water in that. It's just apple juice and honey.
No kidding.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You know, most of the ciders there are about 8-9%. They basically taste like cider that's been bumped up a little. So I want to do something different. So we went really big on the sizer, 15% sizer.
Have you been in North Carolina all your life there?
No, I moved here when I started the meadery, in fact.
Oh, okay. So you're not from North Carolina then?
No, I mostly grew up in New York, lived in Northern Virginia for about a decade or so, and then came down to North Carolina.
What kind of honeys were available to you out there?
Yeah, the local honey in this area is tulip poplar and locust. Goldenrod is another one that I use that's near. Of course, orange blossom I can get from Florida very easily. I tend to like the darker honeys, and I think tulip poplar makes a really nice mead. It's fairly dark, gives kind of a caramelish flavor to it, which I really like.
Yeah.
Do you use the same honeys in all of your meads, or does each mead have its own unique honey that calls for that recipe?
Yeah, each one is different. Every mead that I've made is always built from the ground up on its own. Different honey, different yeast perhaps, different oak, whatever. You know, I don't just take sort of like this baseline and add blackberries to it or something like that. Every single one of our seven meads is very different from each other. The special reserve is even more unique in that it uses buckwheat honey, and we don't use that in any other mead. But in the other six meads, I do different blends, different honeys.
This braggot that I've got going has got some honey. It came from just up the road from you near Hickory, North Carolina. It's a blackberry honey from up there.
Huh? Cool.
I've
used some honey from around there.
Where is Asheville located?
Western.
Asheville, it's about 2 hours west of Charlotte.
2 hours west. Oh, okay. You're all right.
Yeah, we're very close to the Tennessee and Georgia borders.
Ah, okay. All right. The reason why I asked, I've got a couple of friends that live over in the Samora Milton area, which is up by the Virginia border, over by let's say the Raleigh-Durham area.
Okay.
So that's quite a ways, I know, because they're about, I want to say almost 2 hours to Charlotte from their house. So you're quite a ways more west then.
Yeah. We are actually closer to Atlanta than Raleigh.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's about three hours to Atlanta, but it's about a four-hour drive to Raleigh.
Interesting.
Yeah, Asheville's kind of in the middle of nowhere. There's no really other major sites or cities in Western North Carolina.
Yeah.
Your closest big place or fairly good-sized place would be, what, Johnson City or something?
Yeah, Johnson City's about an hour north of here.
All right.
So one other question, and this one's going to kind of come out of left field a little bit, but Jason, do you ever cook with mead at all?
I do. I think the ginger apricot makes an awesome marinade, and I use it for that. And anytime we're cooking and we see a recipe that asks for wine, of course we throw in a Fox Hill mead instead.
Nice. I could see that actually. The ginger apricot, I was thinking like, yeah, it's delicious on its own, but there's got to be some place for it in the culinary world with food as well. So I'll keep
pork chops.
Keep that in mind. Yeah.
Pork chops.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of places in Asheville that use the ginger apricot as part of a cocktail as well. It makes a really good mixer.
Yeah, I would.
Go ahead, JD. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was gonna say, I would take that apricot and reduce that down and make a glaze and brush that over a nice pork roast.
Yeah, I was thinking about poaching a pork roast in that. That sounds pretty good too.
Okay, let's stop talking about food. I haven't even had dinner.
You're right.
Yet, so.
We're going to need to have another dinner here. That's no good.
Yeah. Speaking of cooking, Jeff did a, or maybe Jeff and Aaron did this as a team. Bochet. Have you tried any Bochets yet?
I have not, no. Have you guys had good luck with it?
No.
I no. have not. Jeff and Aaron, you guys did a team brew. What was it? Was that one of the coffees you did with the Bochet?
That was the coffee, yeah.
It was, yeah. Actually, Jason, I don't know if you remember, but after we did the tasting and tour, when we were standing outside of the meadery there, we were just chatting a little bit about that coffee Bochet. So it was right around the same time that Jeff and I were putting that together. But Jeff, tell us again what all went into that one.
Let's see. For mine, I had about half a pound of some East Timor sourced some nice light roast coffee beans that had just basically been cold steeped for a day. In my water, I did about half and half of my honey was I put it in a crock pot and let it basically cook down to being like molasses dark. The other half I just left alone, and I think that was about it. I think that was all I ended up doing with it.
Yeah.
Now, have you bottled that yet?
Actually, I just did. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, mine's sitting in secondary, and I'm just to the point where I'm starting to be able to see through it a little bit. So it's not quite there in terms of the clarity that I'm looking for, but I'm getting antsy. I'm trying to get it in the bottle here before the holidays. So hopefully,
yeah. I just wanted to free up a fermenter.
I hear you.
Yeah, and my Bochet is coating the inside of the sewer lines from here to Long Beach. You know, the caramelized honey is amazing by itself. And I've done, I bet I did 15 pounds of honey. Different temperatures, you know, different colors. Amazing. Just a simply amazing tasting honey, but when I put it together with some yeast and some water and let it ferment, I took one little sip and it went right down the drain. So not something that I can appreciate. So no, mine, no.
Didn't quite do it for you.
No, not at all.
I still got this idea. I still got that s'mores idea. For some reason, I just think that there's a way to make a Bochet into a s'mores mead, maybe with a little Metafoam honey and some chocolate, and I just got to figure out the peanut butter.
Well, yeah. I mean, that actually sounds good. And like I said, the caramelized honey by itself, amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, you get this caramely marshmallow campfire flavor that really hard to beat, you know. But as a fermented drink, now mind you, that's, you know, was the only one that I've ever done, so I really haven't fully experimented with it, and I'm sure Jeff's is probably going to taste pretty amazing. So
I've had some success with a few different ones using the caramelized honey, and you know, some came out pretty good, some came out kind of it's all right, but yeah. I've never had one that I went outright no, I'm getting rid of this is bad.
Well,
so what about your why don't you talk a little bit about how you handle your nutrient additions and what you prefer for nutrients, and give us a little rundown on that.
Okay, well, I think I'm pretty standard on that. I use GoFirm to rehydrate the yeast. I put in DAP at the beginning of the fermentation and some more DAP after the lag phase. And then after about a third of the way through fermentation, I use Ferm8K. I think that's probably pretty normal type of nutrient schedule. Mm-hmm. Is that about what you guys do?
Yeah, well, I think most of us have gotten away from DAP for various reasons. I still use DAP occasionally if it's an extremely high starting gravity. I've got a couple of meads that I make that I start up around 1162, 1164, and those seem to benefit from a little DAP at the beginning and right after lag phase, but then it's pretty much Fermade K from there on. Aaron did a full experiment with all different kinds of nutrient schedules and everything, but I know some of the guys use Fermade O. They follow Sergio Mutella's Tajna protocol, and I think we've all sort of got different, slightly different methods and preferences, but it all basically comes down to giving it what it needs just when it needs it, rather than dumping it all in at the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, that and Fermade K, it just seems like such a popular nutrient. Believe it or not, I've never used it. I've done the Fermade O route, but after hearing about Jeff's results from the nutrient experiment, I think I'm going to have to play around with that.
Well, and here's the funny thing, though.
You did the varietal. Jeff did the nutrients. I keep getting mixed up.
Yeah.
Well, and here's the funny thing about that nutrient schedule experiment, because I initially reported that I had a really good result from starting with Fermado and then finishing out like the 72-hour feeding and the one-third sugar break feeding with a combination of Fermade K and DAP. Initially, that yielded the best flavor to me, but then trying it at about the five-month mark on mead day, I found... Actually, I got a lot cleaner flavor from Fermade O, and then the one that finished with Fermade K and DAP was kind of it just had a little off flavor after having aged that long. So for long term stability, I'm kind of edging towards Fermade O now.
Do you still have any bottles of that left?
I have bottles here and there. I've kind of been using up some of them as kind of a what I want to say, like a junk meat, or if I'm going to cook with it, or if I'm going to, if I've just got friends over and they've been drinking already and they want more to drink, like, oh, okay, well, here, have a bottle of this.
There you go. I'm just interested to hear your thoughts as it continues to age and see how it goes over time.
And Jeff, do you know the yeast strain that you were using for those experiments?
Actually, for that one, I used D47 just because it was the one I was the most experienced with at the time. I will say, having been exposed to these guys, I've been edging more towards using 71B lately, too.
Uh-huh. It'd be interesting to know if that makes a difference as well.
Yeah, that was one of the plans for future experimentation that I just kind of haven't gotten to yet.
Yeah, there's only so many fermentations you can do, right?
Right, yeah, well, no, before the wife says, no, get all these bottles out of my kitchen.
Well, unless you live at my house.
Oh,
yeah. My wife called from the other room. She's already said that, Jeff.
Yeah, well, unless you live at JD's house, where I bought one of these stainless steel fermenters from SS Brewtech, seven gallon. I liked it so much I had to get another one. And of course I've got all the immersion chillers and everything. I got this whole corner in my other bedroom that's just, you know, that's like the mead room, the brew room, set up pretty well. So but it's been a lot of fun for sure. I mean I'm retired. This is part of my weekly, daily routine. You know, spend a couple hours horsing around with these meads, and I do other things besides that. I just got into beers. You know, the Braggot thing. I'm really, really interested in this Braggot thing. Got a couple of those going, and I also do wine, regular grape wine as well. So. But hey, Jeff or Jason, we've kept you here quite a while. couple other segments we want to get to before our night is over with. If you want to stick around, you're more than welcome, but certainly appreciate you coming on board with us here tonight, and love to have you on again.
I would love to. I'm going to go ahead and take off, but thank you very much for having me, and enjoy the Bragg experiments, and I look forward to getting a sample.
You betcha. All right.
Yeah, would you like, before you go, Jason, would you like to tell people where they can find your mead?
Well, you can go on to our website. It's www.foxhillmead.com. And we do ship to, 44, 45 states, something like that. And we're distributed throughout North Carolina and Georgia.
Very good.
All right.
Very good. Well, hey, yeah, thanks again, Jason. Pleased to meet you. And again, we hope to have you back on the show again.
Hey, I would love to. I had a lot of fun. Take care, guys.
Bet.
Thanks, Jason.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Always fun to talk to guys who start out at home and then, turn it into a profession. I like to hear about the mistakes. I mean, what did they encounter on the way, and it kind of gives us an idea of what to look for. And this thing with the puree, the one thing I didn't ask him, and I think we've mentioned it a few times on the show before, guys, is using puree. But I mean, wouldn't that leave a whole lot of stuff at the bottom of the fermenter? Don't you get like 8 inches of junk at the bottom?
I hear different things. It probably depends a lot on the fruit. There's probably some fruits that are more high in fiber or fiber content than others. I know from what I've heard, like apple is really bad with that when you're using the raw cider like I'm using for my sizer and my cider here. There are some fruits that it's probably not quite as bad.
Yeah.
But if you can always start with like a 6.5 gallon batch, if you can rack into a 6.5 gallon carboy and then come out of that into a 6 gallon and then come out of that into a 5 gallon, you can do plenty of racking and still end up with a 5 gallon batch. So,
he has a point.
Yeah, that's typically what I do is I'll put together a 6 gallon deal, initially looking for the 5 gallons in the end. But yeah, I get the whole racking thing, and then being able to come out with a full carboy after several racking. So we were actually was talking to Chris earlier. We were texting back and forth. I had this peach thing going here, and early on, when it's getting close to finish, I noticed it's like here we go again with the tart thing. Chris said just hey, put it on the back burner, forget about it. So I forgot about it. Tasted it again today, and it's coming around pretty good. The tartness is kind of calming down a little bit. Needed something extra, and I asked him, hey, would you oak a peach? And he said, hell no. He's in our talking, he said he's going to, throw out an email this afternoon, and he did. I know you all got it. And, Chris, we wanted to get into the bottling, packaging, cork, zorks, caps, and otherwise.
Yeah, I just wanted to get everybody's opinion on how you package your mead. And do you do it by style, or do you do it by whatever you happen to have available? Or, what's your take on it? Because I know what I do. I like to... I sort of go by style, more or less. Most of the things I do, I use a wine bottle with a synthetic corks. And occasionally, if I'm in a hurry, I might use the Zorks. And then, like for this Braggot, I just don't feel right corking it. I mean, for this Braggot, I want to carbonate it, and I want to put it in a beer bottle because that, I think that's where it belongs.
Yeah.
So I kind of go by feeling on that. But, you know, I wanted to get your opinion, everybody's opinion on that. And since the holidays are coming up, let's talk about not only bottling, but let's talk about labeling and maybe giving your brews as gifts.
Yeah. Aaron, what do you do? Well, I already know what Aaron does. He likes beer bottles. Did we lose Aaron? Did we lose everybody?
Well, I'm still here. I think we might have lost Aaron, though.
No, he's still online. Aaron, you there?
Maybe he drank too much.
Hey, so, hey. Oh, there he is.
There he is.
Sorry, having trouble unmuting my line here.
okay.
Technical difficulties. No, still here. Yeah,
right.
No,
go ahead.
So as someone who got into the whole mead making thing kind of by means of brewing beer first, when I first started getting into it, I mean, I probably got over 100 empty beer bottles down here that kind of circulate from batch to batch. So that's what I do for all of my meads is beer bottles with crown caps. I will say, I think there's something just very elegant in the presentation and appearance that you get from putting it in a wine bottle with a cork, that, you know, something just kind of aesthetically that you don't get from the more utilitarian brown beer bottle. But for me, I've got the equipment for the beer bottling, and that's the way I've gone in the past.
And I love his labels too. They're little colored dots that go on top of the bottle cap.
Yeah.
They're yard sale stickers.
Well, it's kind of an artisanal, artisan effect in a little handwritten little dot that goes on top of it.
Yep, little label telling you what it is. Is it a Braggot? Is it a Raspberry Melomel? What was the bottling date? Yep.
Hey, at least they're color-coded, too, because you sent one of that. I don't know, it's color-coded, you know?
Yep,
so,
yep.
Jeff, what do you, you have any preferences, bottling wise and corks and kind of thing?
I kind of have a parody in there with Chris that, I try to do, according to style. The more wine style ones I like to put in a wine bottle, the beer styles or the small batch experiments, I tend to put in beer bottles just because, well, really I've got a lot of both floating around. Now, when it comes to stuff that I want to have a good presentation on, I almost always put those in wine bottles. And I know I've plugged them on the show before, but there's this company called Bottle Mark that did gorgeous full-color vinyl wine labels for the ones we served at the wedding. And, you know, they had really gorgeous, luscious color to them. They came out great. They stood up to being stuck in a cooler all night. With no runs, and they peeled right off, which is great for me too. So when I put those together, I had really nice labels. I got the foil shrink caps to go over the neck of the bottle after you cork it.
Yeah.
And you know, you can put together a pretty nice presentation on the cheap if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Tell us what's the name of that place again where you did it?
It's Bottle Mark. Bottlemark.com.
Bottlemark.com.
Okay. That's good to know, because I was actually looking around at some labels. What I wanted to do with this Braggot for the bottles, I wanted to actually have the label with the little necker sticker to go around the neck of the bottle also. And
yeah.
So I came across a couple of sites, and there's some really good ones out there.
Well,
if you'll
now,
just do a Google search.
I will say this, Bottlemark only does one size, and it's actually more of a traditional beer bottle size than a wine bottle size, although it worked great for what we needed. They don't do the neckers or extra sizes, so for being like half the price of anybody else out there doing custom labels, there is a little bit of a trade-off, but otherwise they scored really high as far as just really great customer service, really fast turnaround time, great printing and presentation. Fantastic product. So I recommend them enthusiastically, and I would totally use them again.
Yeah.
Well, JD, what do you like to do? Have you bottled enough of yours, or do you just usually?
Well, I have. And I usually buy bottles. If I need bottles, I'll sometimes buy them. But there's a restaurant here that I've been able to hook up with, and they serve, they've got a full bar, and a very large, good size wine list. And I asked them if, I could have their empty wine bottles. So they call me every once in a while. They know that I won't take the screw top ones, and I would say probably 98% of the wine bottles that they have are not screw type. They're the regular cork bottles. That's a good source if you're looking for wine bottles. That I've bought bottles before from my homebrew store too. When I use that, obviously I use the corks. And I don't use the full synthetic. I use the ones that are, I don't know what you call them. They're like part synthetic and part cork.
You're talking about the agglomerated? Amalgamated.
Yes. Yeah, Chris.
Agglomerated, that's the word.
Yeah. I have tried. I don't like the synthetic ones because they just seem like they go in very loosely. And I don't like the full cork ones because even the number 9 size, they go in really tight, and they've come apart on me when I've tried to get them back out of the bottle. But there's a whole, procedure you have to go through with them, in order to get the corks hydrated enough so that they compress down correctly to go in the bottle. That's a whole science. So the I don't have that problem with. So
I've been using full synthetics, and I tried a couple that I did not like at all, and I settled on the Noma corks. If you get out there and you know, you can use Google and you can find a source for Noma corks.
Noma corks.
NOMA. Noma corks.
Okay.
And the ones that I got, I found through a mail order place up in New York. I believe it was Waterloo container or something like that. But they will sell in smaller quantities. And the only caveat to that is you probably do not want to use a hand corker with them, because it's not that they're hard to get in, but they tend to perforate the cork. If you've got a full corker, like the Portuguese full corker with the with the synthetic, but you want to have the synthetic jaws, don't
right.
the brass, and they will not mar those corks, and they will seal good. The good thing about those is that once they're compressed down, they will be loose for a while, but they tend to have memory to their size, so they'll swell back up. And you have zero worry about cork taint. There's no TCA to worry about there. They can be sterilized with a sulfite solution. You don't have to soak them or anything like that. And but as far as the bottles are concerned, my biggest problem is with using restaurant bottles is that I do most of mine in 375s because I tend to do very heavy, very sweet. It's not the kind of thing that you want to sit down and drink,
drink old bottle of.
Yeah, it's the stuff I make is more after dinner, or maybe you have some with a brownie or a piece of cake or something. And so that's kind of what I do. So I tend to go with the 375s. One trick for labels, if I'm just doing a square label or something, print it out, go ahead and design it, print it out on a laser printer, and you can use a mixture of Knox gelatin and water to put that on. It will not run if it's on a laser printer. And the good thing is, when it's cold, it won't come off. So you can put it down in an ice chest full of water and ice water, and it won't come off. When you get ready to take it off, put it in a sink full of hot water, and in just a few minutes, the labels will just come off themselves, and it leaves no residue.
Yeah.
So that's another option.
That's a difficulty that I have with the restaurant bottles that I get. Well, even the bottles that I, you know, my wife and I will buy wine at the liquor store, and of course I'll keep the empties, and getting the label off is sometimes a real hassle. So in that regard,
have you ever tried soaking them in powdered brewery wash?
No, I haven't tried that.
You need to try that. That makes removing labels super easy. There are some kinds of labels that doesn't work on, but I find at least 80% of the labels that I encounter, you know, you fill up one of your buckets with some hot water, add the right amount of PBW to it, and let it sit overnight. The next morning, the labels have already fallen off of most of them, and then the residue just kind of gums off with a little bit of rub on a paper towel or even with your thumb. It's really nice, saves you a lot of headache and work, I tell you what.
Yeah, and one of the online supplies, it's either More Beer or Midwest Supply or Northern Brew, some place online actually sells a powdered label remover specifically for that. So that might work better. I don't know. I've never tried it, but I do have some PBW, and I'll give that a try next time.
Yeah, PBW expensive at the homebrew stores, but I tell you what, you can pick up an 8-pound jug of the stuff on Amazon really cheaply, and that will. I've barely touched it, and I've been using it pretty consistently. It really goes a long way.
Yep, and another little tip for washing your bottles: if you run out of PBW, go to Walmart, get you some OxiClean with the no scent, no color, no nothing, just pure OxiClean.
Yeah, does I've wonders. Got that.
Does wonders for cleaning your brew equipment. It's an oxygen cleaner. I'm not totally convinced that it's all that different from PBW, to be honest.
It's very similar. I think the only difference that I've heard is that with OxiClean, you have to rinse afterwards. From what I've heard with PBW, you can take it right to StarSan.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, you definitely have to rinse the OxiClean, but it's a hell of a cleaner, and it will get stuff off with almost no scrubbing at all. So just a little side note.
The labels that I use are actually Avery labels. They're Avery wine labels. And if you've gone to my Facebook page in the past, you may have seen some of the wine labels that I've made. I'm quite proud of them. And maybe I can throw a few samples up on our page, on our Facebook page and on the website. But you know, as everybody knows, I'm kind of an amateur photographer, and I'll go out and shoot, and then, you know, there might be a bunch of pictures that I think might work on a label, which has been the case the last couple of labels that I made. One was actually a beach, actually a sunrise in Wilmington, North Carolina, when we were out there over the summer, went on to one of my labels, which really came out very nicely. And then another one was a moonlit night, a cloudy night, and the moon was just above the clouds. And that came out very nicely, too. But I print them out on I don't have a laser printer, Chris, but I've got a really, really expensive laser, I mean, inkjet printer. That really puts out a nice color image. But then I take a fixer that artists use for sketches, and I'll spray that over the top of the label. I found that that helps with a little bit of water resistance, but if you do get the label wet, it's going to curl up and peel off. But
well, I've often heard of people using Krylon clear, and just spray a couple of coats on and
yeah, you waterproof. Can do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll use the label together in layers on Photoshop, and then it's saved as a layered file. Then I open it up with Illustrator, Adobe Illustrator, and it gets printed from there. But that's how my labels are done. And like I said, I'm pretty proud of them. after that,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I thought you were finished. I'm sorry.
Well, no. After that, you know, what do you do with it after you get the label on it and the cork in it and all that good stuff? How do you, you know, how do you gift it to somebody? You just hand them the bottle or, you know?
Well, that's what I was going to say because Jeff had mentioned in the email about how do you fix it up to give as a gift if you want to do it because the holidays are coming up. And, you know, I have seen, and I can't think off the top of my head, I can't remember where I saw this, but there are actually wine gift boxes that will hold one bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen that?
I've not seen the gift boxes, but I've seen gift bags that are sized for one specific bottle of wine or sized specifically to hold a bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Used those a couple times. Usually when I do it, I put a little tag on it on a piece of ribbon and I tie a nice bow around the neck of the bottle and do it that way. I mean, you know, less fuss.
Well, one of the things that I like to do is use brown craft paper and tie it with some butcher's twine. But in order to pull that off, you have to sort of lean toward an antique or an old-fashioned label. So that's sort of what I do if I'm not in a, you know, I said one time that I did these mock prescriptions that I use for labels. That, you know, throughout the year, that's what I normally do. But when I want to give a gift, normally I will do some sort of old-fashioned-looking label. And maybe print it on parchment or something like that. Make it look real old, and then you can wrap it in simple brown craft paper, tie it up with some butcher's twine, maybe a little ribbon. And it really kind of gives the feeling of something, an old-fashioned feel, you know.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things to do, I think I've mentioned before, I'm a sort of a World War II buff. So I like to do World War II themed labels, maybe with some pinup girls or maybe some old fighter planes or something.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I like some of the nose art on some of the old fighter planes and kind of do some peak labels and then just wrap it up. This is kind of like a military issue, you know, just, you know, you kind of create a theme with it.
Yeah. How cool. I know, if you're good using Photoshop, you know, that allows a lot of creativity as well. And, you know, I use that together with a couple of other programs for my photographs. But I've been pretty fortunate. You know, I've got probably 15,000 photographs that I've taken over the last few years that I can pick from. Now, mind you, most of them are birds, but, you know, I do have some other stuff in there, flowers and stuff that that I've toyed around with. So if you're, you know, if you got, you know, a creative mind and are pretty decent with Photoshop, why, you know, that's an alternative as well. And Jeff, I like the idea. The problem that I have with making labels at home for beer bottles is like Chris is talking about, the little neck piece. And unfortunately, I can't buy labels that I can print here at home for a beer bottle.
Right.
And
Avery just needs to get on the homebrew line and
yeah, you think
pull
you
those
know?
Off.
Yeah. So I'm going to be relegated. I found a couple of sites out there, but I haven't looked at the one that you mentioned, Bottle Mark, and I'll have to check that out as well. Chris, are you still looking for an Oktoberfest braggart?
Yeah. You know, like I
said,
did
you find one?
I'm not really a big beer fan at all, but since we got started in this, it's sort of one of those things where you don't tell me I can't do it, because I'm going to keep on until I do. And you know, that's kind of where I'm at right now. And like I said, I can't make a good braggart unless I can make a good beer. And so I've been doing a lot of research, a lot of studying and reading up on it, and trying to cut through some of the hype. You know, I mean, there's a lot of hype going around, and it's like, oh, if you do all grain, it's complicated. But it's really just a series of steps. And if you take it one step at a time, it's not really that complicated.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to understand it and get a feeling for it, but I'm still at the stage where I can't just come up with a recipe. I don't understand the ingredients enough to do that. But
me too.
You know,
yeah.
I was tasting some beers at the store the other day. There's a little place down on the corner that has samples on tap, and came across this Oktoberfest, and it's basically everything I like. It's malty. It's got some sweetness. It's not bitter. It's very low on hops. And it's got a good mouthfeel, good body to it. And when I tasted it, I said, that's the one. That's what's got to go in a braggart. And so that's going to be my next thing. And I guess I'll probably start out with an extract, just more or less as a test batch, and then probably going to step it up to an all grain. But if anyone out there has a good all grain Oktoberfest, give, you know, shoot us an email if you want to share your recipe, because that's really going to be the basis for this braggart.
Yeah, I just the other day, oh, in fact, yesterday, in fact, I just racked my second braggart. This is the other bourbon barrel. Remember, I bought the two kits, and I got to apologize to Patty Mackey. I was going to do the bourbon barrel deal side by side, make one a beer, like, you know, according to the kit, and then obviously the other one with the braggart. So the first braggart, you know, it's been sitting on the oak and the bourbon now for several weeks. And or longer, actually. But then, you know, I had this other kit, and I thought, you know, after talking to Michael Fairbrother, I thought, you know, I think I'm going to do this one as a braggart and do like he says, just pull 2 pounds of malt out and add, just replace that with, you know, replace it with honey. And that's what I did. So I'm curious as how this is going to compare. Now, I used Evan Williams in this one. I used Eagle Rare in the other. But the same deal. I soaked the oak cubes in some bourbon and put the whole mess in the carboy when I racked it. However, the big difference, okay, it is going to come out, and again, I don't have my notebook in front of me. I want to say it's something close to 12 or 13%, I believe. Remember, that one had an additional 6 pounds of honey. So that ramped up the ABV. Now, this one that I just racked, it's still in secondary fermentation. It's still fermenting. It'll bubble here and there. But right now it's sitting at 5.3, which is basically beer strength. So as far as the honey doing anything extra, it really didn't. So perhaps what we're looking for there is some inkling of the honey aroma of, I don't know, whatever flavors might come out of it. I have no idea. So that's the other Braggot experiment. Now,
what I'm looking for with this Oktoberfest is to have a classic Oktoberfest that's backed up with an additional honey backbone, honey aroma, honey flavor.
Yeah.
But to keep it smooth, I want more alcohol in there than a normal beer would have, obviously. But I want it to be hidden. And I want it to remain just as smooth and enjoyable as an Oktoberfest beer, but yeah, with honey component. And, you know, if I can pull that off, I think it would be the perfect Braggot, because it's the kind of thing that it goes down so easy and so smooth. You think you're drinking an Oktoberfest, and you get halfway through the glass and you start wondering, who the hell is in here kicking my ass?
Go ahead.
No, that's what I'm looking for. I want to keep it nice and smooth and malty and just kick it up with a honey backbone to it.
Remind me, Aaron, that Braggot that you sent, if you recall, do you recall the malt? What kind of malt extract? What you used in that?
I do. Let me pull that up. I think it was just a light malt extract, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. It was really good.
While Aaron's looking that up, Jeff has sort of had the same idea that I had, except with the box instead of the Oktoberfest.
Yeah, and really, I'm still playing around with which Bock recipe that I want to use. I actually found, I don't know if I ever mentioned it, my wife got me a membership to the American Homebrew Association for Father's Day, and that's been really fun to check out some of their articles on there. It's actually been a really great gift. They had one for a Doppelbock that they just put up on the website not too long ago called the Maltinator, and that one looks pretty promising because I've got a conversion for making it extract. My thought was I can just take some of that extract, the LME out of that and put in honey instead, to get the same kind of a gravity read. And that should get me where I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking that with the Oktoberfest and the Bock so much on the same level, just, you know, you've got a slight difference in malt profiles, but the overall impression of the two beers are basically very similar.
Yeah.
So we'll probably end up with something pretty much the same. I'm guessing that's going to be my guess.
Well, yeah, they're going to be pretty close, I'm sure.
Yeah.
This recipe that I'm thinking about is a Doppelbock, so it is on the darker side, but it should be nice and sweet, malty, with a low kind of a Hallertau hops flavor to it, if any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at probably using Tetnang or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of noble German hop.
Right.
I really want to stay true to style with the beer component, but then go out of the box with the honey addition. I think my goal in this is to keep it just as smooth and easy drinking as the beer itself.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I really want to accomplish with it.
I think the Oktoberfest, it almost has almost a honey flavor to it in and of itself. I mean, you described it as kind of malty or biscuity, but kind of that sweetness, I think, would just lend itself very well to a Braggot style.
Yeah, and I'm thinking this blackberry honey is going to be perfect, because the blackberry honey in and of itself has a maltiness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be perfect. That's the one I used in the Irish Red Ale. and the malty character is really starting to come through in that thing. I think that's going to be one hell of a bracket. I really do. But there's just something about the body that it comes back to my dislike of most beer. Most beer is just, I don't know, it's either too bitter or it's too thin. And some of the ales like that, like the reason I picked the Irish Red was because it was an ale that did have a little bit more body to it. But when I tasted the Oktoberfest, I knew right away that was what I wanted to go with.
Yeah.
Damn. Sounds good. Well, hey, JD, that braggot that I sent to you called for a Pilsen malt extract syrup. It is a pale malt syrup that's made from Pilsner malt and carapils.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that was, really good. And that's what set me off on this braggot thing. And I've had different, I've been able to find different brands of mead out here finally over the course of the last year. And different varieties, different styles, and some I really like, some I don't, and it's not that these meads taste bad, it's just that they're not quite my thing. But that braggot, that was really, really good. I really enjoyed that. That's what kind of kicked me off on this braggot. So I think maybe that's my style of mead.
Well, definitely. Yeah, we got a good one though, because we got to get Jason something. We could have a bottle that Fox Hill Meadery presents.
Yeah.
The Mead House.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Finally, here at the show, as we get wrapped up. The coffee thing is starting to, this thing has been on my mind. I can't let it go. And I've been thinking about this for so long. And I've got one more coffee experiment that I feel the need to try. And my wife and I had a cup of coffee a few nights ago with a little bit of Kahlua and some cream. And I love my homemade Kahlua. I can't even keep the stuff in the house. My wife keeps giving it away. And I thought, I wonder, and I asked Chris, I think I called Chris or we talked about it, but I'm going the complete other direction now with it. And I'm thinking something more of a Kahlua-like coffee mead. Something really heavy, thick, super sweet coffee. Okay. And as I was asking Chris about the gravity, what was the highest gravity? and what was it? Remember what yeast it was, Chris?
Well, I've always used 71B with high gravity.
71B.
The highest one I've ever started with was 1164. That's the highest starting gravity I've ever done. But you remember Michael Fairbrother said he had started way up higher than that with some. So
yeah.
I have no doubt that 71B can handle it, but it's going to take some coaxing at the beginning, because it will start slower and it will ferment slower until it gets going. Once it breaks through a certain gravity, then it'll take on off and go like normal.
Yeah, I'm thinking of I'm thinking small batch here. I'm thinking 1 gallon, and that's my thought. I haven't really fully wrapped my head around it yet and really nailed down. But it's going to be along the lines of a traditional to start. And then I think it was Patty Mackey shared with us on a show one night that she had the best flavors come out of racking on to coffee beans for a period of time. And I think that might be the route I go with it. And, you know, so that's I think I'm on the right track there. If I think in the lines of a Kahlua with a nicely done heavy traditional with some vanilla coffee bean, maybe an orange peel or two, I think I might be able to get it to come out almost like a Kahlua. So that's what's on the back of my mind right now. So, other than that, guys, we've pretty much run out of time for the night. Now, I want to remind everybody, we're going to be off next week again. Happy Thanksgiving. Be safe and all that kind of good stuff. Don't burn the turkey, for crying out loud. We'll come back the week after that, and then I think we're here for a few weeks and be off again for Christmas. Ryan, hope you enjoy the show. We missed you tonight, bud. Want to thank Jason Russ for being on the show with us tonight. Fox Hill Meadery in Asheville, North Carolina, if you're ever in the area. FoxHillMeadery.com, I think, was the place, Aaron. Thanks for putting that together for us. And tell you what, why don't we all come back here in a couple of weeks, a week after Thanksgiving, and we'll do this all over again. In the meantime, be safe. See you then.